Oliver Callan on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by It's for Women. Discover female health insurance through It's for Women.
Social storytelling is a cure for loneliness, everybody. Jane Gormley set up Crackley Stories, and this is all about getting the oral tradition of yarns and modern folklore, I suppose, out to people around the country, and especially in rural parts, and it's working very well, I'm glad to hear. And it turns out we love hearing tales, whether it's on a bale of straw or over the crystal clinking dinners. Jane Gormley, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Crackley Stories, when did you set this up, by the way? How long is it running? It
kind of officially about a year and a half ago. Oh, we were secretly in operation before that.
Yeah. What do you mean secretly?
Well, I mean, just not, we didn't invite people or sell tickets. We just, it was amongst friends.
Oh, so, yeah. So it kind of started organically in that way.
Indeed, on an organic farm, yeah.
On an organic farm. Is that your farm?
Well, my husband is a farmer. That's where I live. That's where we live. And that's where he's from. Yeah.
I feel like you're clarifying things.
Yeah.
There's lots of women who live and work on farms who don't consider themselves farmers. But anyway, that's a whole other story. But so you were kind of socially, social occasions, chatting and telling stories, and you decided we could make something of this if we organise it.
Yeah, exactly. So shall I tell you how it all began?
Okay.
So, well, I suppose firstly, the farm is an important character in this story, because these things can be hard to do, even if you want to, if you don't have some space. And I didn't grow up on the farm, and I moved there about 7 years ago. And it had a real impact on me, actually. And, you know, I suppose just observing rural life and, you know, the activities around the farm. But on a very practical basis, there's sheds and there's fields. And yeah, in the summer, the cattle are out, and we sort of reclaim the sheds, and we would have parties in them. And so this gradually, as a few things that I came aware of, I've always loved storytelling, and I get a lot of comfort from it. I really enjoy it. But post-COVID, the kind of loneliness epidemic, I suppose, a few pennies started to drop as to how big a problem this was. And so that sort of kickstarted the idea.
How did you, you noticed loneliness, didn't you, in your main job, your everyday occupation?
Yeah. So I come from a recruitment background, and I work in a training environment now, a technology training environment. And a lot of the contracts that we work with would, not all exclusively, but some of them would be government funded and would work with people who are maybe trying to use these skills to get back into the workforce. Mm-hmm. And there's challenges to that. And, you know, I got exposed basically through that work, through a huge amount of European programs and talk groups and action groups to try and figure out about the issues around social isolation. And then the more I read about it, the more I realised what an issue it was. And I suppose I just said no one day, and I'd had enough. I thought it was so sad. And I thought, there's so many things that you see that you can do so little about. At least that's how it feels sometimes. But this was something I thought, well, you can do loads about this. Like, you have a shed, you bring people there all the time, and they always leave feeling kind of relaxed and cleansed, and you know, there's no technology, it's just really good crack. And that's how it came about.
What did the loneliness that you discovered around the place, what does it kind of look like? What does it look like for people who are lonely?
So it can be really chronic and crippling, and it can happen gradually, and or it can happen quite quickly. Like, we were all in lockdown, I suppose. I know it was a period of a couple of years, but, you know, it was so instantaneous. And I think within 6 months, we had undone centuries of people being used to just being together. And it can take time. It leaves a residue. And
some people didn't emerge.
Didn't emerge the same. And, you know, and I suppose in my immediate family, there's multiple age groups, you know, from a then 4-year-old to a 15-year-old to my own age group, to my parents' age group, and nobody escaped unscathed. But what we were seeing, like, professionally, was that people just literally couldn't kind of rebuild their lives and couldn't get back to work and couldn't mix. Children can't communicate well, are unused to emotional reactions. Adults, you know, just that sense of fun and looseness. And look, these evenings are just fun. You know, they're really good crack. We don't sit around talking about loneliness, but I thought it was something that I could do that would remind people of how important we are to each other. And, you know, stories can start revolutions. They can soothe babies. They can do all sorts of things. But fundamentally, they keep us together, and they make you think about what other people are experiencing, and that might influence your behaviour. And I think that's really the crux of it.
Do you think loneliness has come from people being shy and maybe regressed during lockdowns or just a stage in their lives where they regress and suddenly aren't chatting to people as much as they did every day?
Yeah, I think it's habitual. And I think when a seed of fear of mixing with people has been planted, it's very hard to undo that. Mm. But it is also habit forming and people not being so relaxed, people being, you know, physically maybe certainly initially a little bit afraid of being close to people, and then emotionally, you know, become very defensive. Like our digital era we live in, statements are grabbed and kept forever and used against you. And I think people have become very careful in what they say. So yes. We record nothing.
See, people are withdrawing.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. I think people are just being, you know.
There's also lots of evidence. We were talking about the show only recently about if people's eyesight starts to go, they're not getting the tests or they're not refusing to wear glasses or hearing might be going. And rather than being caught out, they tend to withdraw and reduce their kind of their hang out with people, essentially.
Yeah.
And then it becomes, as you say, habit forming.
Yeah.
So before they know it, they're sitting lonely in their houses.
Well, this is it. And it can happen easily. Yeah.
So crackly stories. Yeah. Have you got people out and about? Is it working?
I think so. It's certainly really good fun. And certainly our events are very busy. We're a year and a half doing it now. And like I should add, this is a part-time gig. Like I work full time. And but what has happened is that other people have gotten involved and people have supported it and liked it and come along all the time. And people are a bit unsure of what to expect at the beginning. So like the first night we had it, when we held it in the straw shed, I rang 10 friends and said, will you please bring someone with you that we don't know, so that we have a bit of a mixed group. Yeah. We broke all sorts of health and safety rules, had the most beautiful straw shed covered in bales with a little turf fire in the middle. It was perfectly safe, but yes. So I think people get more confident the more they come to them, and people, you know, at first aren't sure what to expect, and we also host them in very like kind of well thought out places. And when people, by the time people are leaving, like I've often described it, it's like the afters of a wedding, like, you know, the din of conversation, and people come alone often and people come in groups, but everybody kind of leaves knowing each other, which is just really the point of it.
And lose their inhibitions.
to a certain extent. Yeah.
Well, I suppose if everyone is kind of doing a similar thing, that helps, doesn't it?
Yeah. And you have loads in common by the time you leave. So, and everyone's mad to tell their story, even though they may not have volunteered to be one of the curated storytellers. Afterwards, you can be sure that they're telling a story to somebody, and that's all I want from it.
Does anyone come on their own?
Yeah, very often. Yeah.
So they're definitely coming out of their
yes,
comfort.
Yes, yeah.
Where does all your interest in stories and storytelling come from?
I suppose initially reading. I would be an avid reader, like a lot of people are. Conversation people. I write myself. I mean, not professionally, it's not my job, but I write all the time. Yeah, I forgot that. Yeah, I did an English degree.
Don't forget that bit.
Yeah, no, that was important. Yeah, 4 years. I did an English degree after school. And I think
literally
I
called, studying stories.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, I forgot now. But studying stories for 4 years. And look, I went off to college, you know, assumed I'd finish college and go off and like pen all my novels and that would be my life. But loads of other things happened that interfered with that in a wonderful way.
Yes.
And now I'm back. I have a little bit of time and I am writing.
That's becoming
properly.
A mum, I presume, is what you're referring
to.
Oh,
yeah, I did. I had a baby straight after college. His name is Paddy and he's 20 now. So a lot of time has passed. Wow. But yeah, so that... In a lovely way, obviously, sort of.
It totally ends your writing.
Yeah.
But it certainly does. For you. Yeah. It doesn't
well,
for
it
everyone.
Well, it did for me. Yeah.
It did for you. Yeah. Well, it hasn't totally ended it because, of course, you don't have to write things down in order to be writing. If you're storytelling, you're writing.
Yeah, that's true, actually. And I really enjoy oral style. Like, you know, the listening. I just love voices. Like, I've always preferred the radio to TV. You know, that I just, I find
of course.
Voices. Yeah.
Saying all the right
of
things.
Of course, yeah.
And then, so you ended up in recruitment and training, and that was your career. So you're kind of bringing it back to full circle, 20 years.
I suppose I am. Yeah, and I think, you know, life is it can meander. Like the stories have always been there, and it's always been something that I've. And I'm not alone in this. I think you get a lot of comfort from stories, and I think a lot of enjoyment and a lot of fun, and understanding other people and maybe where they're coming from and experiencing that. But I hadn't really planned this. Like this wasn't this happened, and it's, you know, it's also down to a lot of responses from people. Like we I'm just back from the Waterford Food Festival, and that first night, it's a nice link. That first evening in the shed, one of my friends is a lady called Eunice Power, and she's a chef, and she is a very, very active person, and she seems to get tons done. But she came and she joined us. So, you know, it takes a bit of effort from everyone. Like, she got in her car, she came up, she came to the straw shed, she sat and enjoyed that evening, and then afterwards she said, I loved that, would you bring it to the festival? And then that had us committed, so I had to set up a website and be somewhat legitimate in order to do that.
It's a social enterprise now, is it?
Well, it's not. A social enterprise is a very specific way of organising a business. So it's not technically a social enterprise, but I do have very social ambitions with it. And I would love to have a social enterprise wing. I don't think I'm quite ready yet.
You've no funding from anywhere.
No, not yet. Although I should say,
busy telling stories.
Yeah, I'm too busy telling stories to do the business bit. Yeah, it's great crack, but there's stuff that needs to be set up. Kildare County Council very kindly has just recently awarded us some funding.
Good.
And they're going to help us with that funding will help us bring back to the farm this summer some of our various events that we'll be able to host. Obviously, we can't do it in the farm in the winter months, really, because we haven't got access to the sheds because the cows are there.
But now they're
out.
But you can do it officially now in the sheds, having started kind of rudimentary way.
Yes.
It can be done properly.
Yeah, there's stuff now. People can come along and do that. There's events all year round now. We do at least once a month, and hopefully we'll increase that.
There is a question from Breda, who's a farmer, says, I'd love to start something like this, or perhaps get involved. I'm on a farm with plenty of empty sheds. Does public liability insurance cover this activity?
Shh, Breda.
Well, Kildare County
it does. No, we do, obviously. Yeah. We do have insurance on the farm, yes. So you can ring your insurance company to get the answer. But yes, you can extend that.
Nothing quite like a downer, like mentioning
insurance. Yeah, I know. Come on, Breda.
Back to crackling stories.
Yeah.
It's not just in farms. You have them everywhere. Tell us where else you've held events.
Yes. So we tend to hold them in kind of interesting spaces. So we have a collaboration at the moment with Historic Houses of Ireland. Mm-hmm. So for anyone who's not familiar with them, they're a group of charitable kind of status, and they work to protect the built heritage of Ireland that's under private ownership. So obviously you'll have your OPW houses and so on. So, but what we're talking about is people's homes.
What's
people's
left
gardens.
Of it? Because
well, this is
gone,
it. Yeah, they have there's a significant amount of these beautiful houses and buildings and gardens in Ireland, and the people in them, they own them privately. They look after them privately. A lot of them open them to a certain extent. Some of them might be hotels and some are totally private. But this is a really important part of our heritage. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, there's a lot of really good work being done there around maintaining that. But for us, from the story side of things, it's a really nice way. It kind of picks up a little bit of the rambling house motif that you're going to people's houses. Mm-hmm. And the big houses are great because they're big. So you can fit a lot. They're designed to host, you know.
Designed to mingle and sit around in big rooms chatting.
Exactly, yeah. And sure, we're all nosy by nature. So it's a lovely chance to go in and have a look and enjoy them. So they've been really successful. We have one happening at the end of June in Ballyvillan. That's the summer series down in Cork. And there'll be a few more announced. We're just organising them. I'm not sure where they're going to be yet.
And I don't know if this is upcoming or was it last year, but there was some in gardens as well.
Yeah, we were in June Blake's garden in Blessington. That was beautiful. Like, have you ever been to...
No, I was looking at pictures online. Is that open?
It is.
It is, okay.
Yeah, June is in Blessington. Yeah, in Wicklow. So June would be a really well-known gardener. And where her garden is also her family home. That's where she grew up.
Yeah.
And they do a lot of events up there now, but the garden was gorgeous, and we were able to use, they've converted a beautiful kind of courtyard into accommodation and a kind of a space, so we had great fun up there. It was
that's
really good.
That's a great
crack.
Idea.
Yeah.
The Law Society, you also did a collaboration. How did that go?
Yeah, we did. So that was last summer. So there's a team in the Law Society who are doing a huge amount of work. They're the psychological unit, and what they do is they're working with solicitors and barristers on improving well-being within the workplace. Mm-hmm. And they're a group called Well Within the Law. It's a project. They have a huge amount of elements to that. But what we were involved in was a summer kind of festival that they host in Blackall. And five members of the industry, like judges, new entrants, people with their own practicing solicitor firms, came and just gave a sort of uncensored insight to...
Judges and solicitors all sitting around telling stories. That's unique, wasn't it?
It's a really important initiative what they're doing, but this was just a really lovely part of it. And people can be very protective in the workplace, and that can lead to...
And particularly in that hospital, in that job where they can be dealing with a lot of grim content.
Yeah, exactly. They have a lot,
I'm sure half of them are like really... They're like actors, aren't they?
Well, you'd need to be a little, wouldn't you?
Yeah, would. Seriously. Like, there is theatre attached to it. Lismore Cathedral as well.
Oh, that was just on Sunday. So it brings us back. That was an event for the Waterford Food Festival, which is just brilliant. And the sun was blazing, but they very generously we were allowed access in Lismore, St. Carthage's Cathedral. And they there's a tiny little library in there called the Cotton Library. And 15 of us were in there telling stories and eating cake.
You're basically snooping in all the nice buildings.
This is, that's what I mean. Like the party fun element of it is like very important, but there's a backbone to it that's trying to...
You're doing a lot of work because the stories are all curated, aren't they? So you know who's going to tell the story in advance.
Yeah.
What, you help them out or tell them how long it should be? What do you
tell them? All of that. So so there's a link. There's always a theme. Each evening is different. The link is supposed to obviously connect to the building and the people around it, and what I'm interested in is what people are doing in their locality. So there's a good bit of pre-work done. People can apply to tell a story, absolutely, and then we'll try our best to kind of fit it into an appropriate session. But I do a lot of research. Again, like it's kind of easy now. You can go on Google, you can look up news reports, you can read articles, you can go on Instagram and find out what people are doing. And then I invite them. And sometimes they say and sometimes they say no.
Well, so you're searching people out and then invite them along. Tell us the story.
Yeah.
How long do you tell them they need to tell the story?
So the story is only ever between 5 and 10 minutes. And then we would have 5 to 6 people telling stories. So the actual storytelling lasts about like roughly an hour 15. There's usually an intro to it and stuff as well. And then before is, so it's a 3-hour session usually, evening time, 7 till 10. 7 o'clock, drinks, grub, bit of chat.
That's the mingling bit.
That's the mingling bit. Yeah. And afterwards, so then
get,
stories
let your
for
guard down.
So have something to read, have some and then the stories, and then afterwards is the post wedding din where everybody wants to tell stories and nobody wants to leave. Yes.
Out the door at 10 o'clock or so. So it's not a...
Roughly,
Not a terribly late night, but some people...
No, we must be respectful of people's houses. And also, we're usually in rural locations, so people have to find a way
home. They make up stories or do they tell something about themselves?
Oh, yes. So these are true stories. So this is not really like kind of performance. It's not literary. It's not an open mic session type of idea. Mm-hmm. It's so, and this is the nice thing that, you know, it's not being presented as a performance or something theatrical. It's just listening to other people's sort of tales. There are occasions when we've brought in folklore, like Halloween, places like, you know, things like that. But funny enough, for our Halloween one, we did have some folklore. Sinead O'Brien from Wandering Stories did perform at that. She's great. But then the people who were telling stories were all telling stories of like having seen a ghost or worked as a medium.
They would be endless. So you have a personal ghost story.
People telling real things that have happened to them. So that was quite an experience.
Very specific to their area and so on.
Yeah. That's harder. Like it's kind of hard to find people who've told, you know, people are doing things they tend to be talking about a little bit, but not everyone talks about.
Do you mean
about
in Ireland where it's like, don't be telling people about what's going on here?
No, we were all dying. So if anyone's got any good ghost stories, please let me know.
That also gives it the idea that it can go all year round, more or less.
The Crackley,
yeah.
Oh yeah, we go all year round. Yep. Yeah.
So we have the poet and spoken word artist Steve O'Toole.
Yes.
Who's on the phone. Good morning, Steve.
Morning, Oliver. How are you?
Very well, thank you. You are one of the people that Jane was telling us she hunts people for stories. You were story hunted.
Well, I volunteered very quickly when I was hunted. Jane and Cracky, just the whole thing just jumped out at me. It really, really did. I'm just sitting here listening to you two yap, and I could sit here all morning listening to you. It's great. This was great.
It's really good. Yeah. Do you have time? Could you tell us a story that you told?
Oh yes, absolutely,
Sit back here and relax.
Always a story ready to go. I suppose. Well, first big thanks to Jane, to yourselves, and to Cracky. I mean, it's just really appreciated. So, yeah, this story I'm going to share is like it's a reflection of past to present. It's about perceived missed opportunities, but most importantly, realizing it's never too late to be not dead yet.
Oh, I love it already.
Okay, so I won't say the end. I'll continue. Okay, to set the scene, I need to take you back to Dublin. It's early 1990.
Yeah,
it's one of those late Irish summer nights. You know what Irish summer weather is like? Well, this is worse. And, you know, this was a bad night. I mean, Dublin, this particular August night, Dublin was being, or well, Ireland was being ravaged by the aftermath of some storm or so. And Dublin had never seen anything like it. Transport had stopped, buses, trains, etc. Now, you've got to remember that this story starts in a time when the internet is in its infancy. Very few people had mobile phones. Those that had, they weren't very smart. Sorry, the phones that weren't very smart. A Irish poet, not myself, who had walked away from his safe RTE job so he could concentrate on writing, self-publishing and selling his books on Dublin streets, was scheduled to play his biggest gig ever in Andrews Lane Theatre. Now, at the time, this pre-online age, the only way to advertise your upcoming gigs was to plaster Dublin with A5 flyers, which he'd been doing so for the last 5 or 6 weeks, advertising this one-night-only event. And then 2 hours before the show, Andrews Lane rang him and said, show's cancelled. Trains aren't running, buses, Dublin's shut, locked down. There's no one, we're killing the show. So he didn't know what to do. So he decided to leave his home. He travelled in by bus into the city centre. He got as far as Parnell Square, and then he had to walk up through the rain and the wind of Collins Street, Westmoreland Street, Dame Street, and up to Andrews Lane Theatre. And he did so on the basis of just in case somebody else was mad enough to have made the same journey. He just didn't want them being disappointed. And one person did turn up, just one idiot, and that was me. And that's how I met my poet hero, Pat Inglesby.
The great late Pat Inglesby.
The great late Pat Inglesby, a very, very good friend of mine. And he went on then, we sat in the theatre bar, and I can still get goosebumps. He sat there and he recited his entire show to me, his one-man audience.
Wow.
I had a personal show, and we literally sat there for 3 hours drinking coffees in the theatre bar. The barman looking at the two of us, kind of going, are they ever going home? So anyway, through that night and through that meeting, myself and Pat became very good friends. He would sell his books on Talbot Street, Westmoreland Street, and he'd go out to Hope Pier and there's somebody who sells books there. And like I say, you know, we are talking about Dublin in 1990. This is a different place then. You know, there was very few spoken words venues, you know, poets, come on. You didn't get a gig anywhere. But when Pat was gigging, he'd always ask me to come along and I'd do the door. So it was £3 in, no euros. But if you had a nod and a wink and a bit of a story, I'm sure I'd let you in for
£1.
So he was making no money and I was making less. But anyway, then one day over coffees, we were sitting in Bewley's in Westmoreland Street, which is now TFI Fridays. And Pat says to me, next week, you're my support act. Now, Pat knew I wrote, but he knew I didn't have the courage to stand in front of the microphone. But he afforded me this chance to speak my own words in front of his pre-given audience. It's a long time ago. I can barely remember it, but I think I read a poem, something about my mother, and then I read a poem, which was a Thank You, Pat poem, which he said was disgraceful and was to never see the light of day again. That promise has been kept to today, and it will continue. Just Jane touched on it there earlier on, you know, it was coming back, you know, through COVID and coming out of COVID, I was kind of thinking back to those days. Yeah. And I was thinking back that I'd missed something. Something had slipped through my fingers. Something that, I just felt I could have had it. There was something there that I didn't finish or I didn't get maybe make a start at, you know. But again, of course, back then I wasn't this, you know, self-assured, confident creative that's speaking to you today. That was a different guy then. I was, shy and quiet and, you know, now give me a microphone. but anyway.
It changed your life, didn't it?
Oh, completely. Absolutely. It completely changed the trajectory I was on. So, but unfortunately, you know, weeks, months, years, travel, work, excuses, a lifetime. I suppose life just got in the way, and somehow myself and Pat didn't see each other as much, and I stopped performing writing crazy. It just got shelved. Life got in the way, as I say, you know?
Yeah.
But then, December 2022, I went to see Seamus Murphy and Tom Bourke's amazing documentary drama, The Peculiar Sensation of Being Pat Inglesby. And I was walking home later up through Stony Batter, and I just thought back on so many memories that I reflected back on the what could have been moments. And there was a particular moment in the film that Pat had said, in Ireland, we are very, very good at commemorating our dead, but we're not very good at celebrating them in their living. And I think we don't have to think too hard, you know, Sinead O'Connor, Shane McGowan, Christy Dignam, Dolores O'Riordan. Yeah. But Pat had further said that there were blue plaques all over Dublin stating how Oscar Wilde lived here or James Joyce sat there or something, you know. And Pat said in the film, in the closing frames of the film, he said, "I want a blue plaque and I want my plaque to say Pat Inglesby was moved from here for selling his books. And I want it now while I'm alive to see it. Thank you very much." And it was when he said that, just something got into my head. It just got this little needle into my head and went, "That's my way. That's my way of getting back to Pat." So, you know, Pat was always a man of letters. He loved receiving letters. So I wrote to Pat, and because I hadn't seen him in a while, and I wrote to Pat and I wanted to just kind of check in and catch up. And I did have a little fear in the back of my head saying that it may be an unanswered letter because I couldn't remember where we were or what had happened. You know, I just couldn't remember. But those fears went out the window. 2 days later, I got a phone call, Pat saying, "Get your arse over here." And I went over.
And you did.
And we sat in I did. And we sat there for 4 or 5 hours drinking.
How did you commemorate again? How did you commemorate him while he was alive?
Well, yeah. So, well, that, actually, thanks. I mean, in the summer of 2023, I was given this opportunity to pay tribute to Pat. And I completed my first Dublin Canvas because I do some art as well as poetry and spoken word. I do some art as well. And Dublin Canvas, for those who are unfamiliar, it's a project run by Dublin City Council where they give over the grey traffic light boxes around Dublin.
The ugly electrical boxes, yes.
Exactly. Well, ugly before I've painted
them. Before they're painted, yes.
Before I've painted them. And so I was given the opportunity to do one in Clontarf at the bottom of the road where Pat lives. So I did it in 2023, and it's a big blue box and it's a picture of Pat's head on it, and underneath is a mock blue plaque and it says "Not dead yet."
Okay. Unmissable. Now, and it's still true, isn't it, even though we've lost him. And Steve, it's a lovely story. And would you believe the man who Pat you through on sound this morning is Dave Gibson, a nephew of Pat Inglesby.
Ah, Dave, yes.
So it's like he's in the room with us this morning.
Well, it is. And, you know, it's funny how things are. That's great. That's brilliant. Hi to Dave, if you're listening, you should be. Listen, but no, and look, to finish up, to be honest, things change. And last summer, myself and Pat were sitting in outside his front door in Clontarf. I read this story to him. I hadn't read it to him before, but I'd been starting to do it and read around town and stuff. And I read it to him, and he said to me, "Well, great, but why did it take you 35 years to write it?" You know, so it kind of, and again, it's more encouraging stuff. But, you know, but of course, at that time, we didn't know how things were going to end, you know. And in late February of this year, I sat at Pat's bedside and I reread this story to him. And a week later, I received a message from Pat's sister, the wonderful Bridgie, who's just been such a good friend to me. And she just sent me a message saying, "Pat is free now and he's gone home." And I was absolutely heartbroken. And Ireland lost its greatest living writer, in my opinion, a wonderful poet, a good friend, a great supporter, and probably my number one fan. And he just, you know, he was very, very good. He never stopped encouraging me. And I just wanted to, you know, the canvas was a kind of public thank you. When Jane gave me the opportunity to come onto your show this morning, I thought it was a great opportunity to have a story. And if you don't mind, if you just indulge me, Oliver, if you don't mind.
I'll have to go because I'm short on time, Steve.
I just finish with a very short piece of Pat wrote?
Yeah, okay.
Very short. Okay, so it's a message from When I'm Gone by Pat Inglesby.
Okay.
"Ireland is as little or no favours you ever did me or my poems when I was alive. I have this terrible feeling that someday after I'm gone, you will swing into your usual rearguard action. So in advance, stick it up your arse." That's from the inevitable. And if you like what I'm doing,
that's
I'm on
the rear guard.
Instagram. Steve, I'm on Instagram, you'll find me there.
Thanks so much. Beautifully told. Steve O'Toole there. Thanks a million. Good luck. Good luck, Sloane. And cracklystories.com is the place, Jane.
That's it.
To find for people to get involved, find out all the events and if they want to join in. And
yeah, exactly. Yeah,
we'll be story hunting.
We'll be story hunting. You can make an application there.
Crackly, as in the Irish version of a C or A-I-C.
Yeah, exactly. C-R-A-I-C-L-Y stories.com or on Instagram. That's it. That's all we can do.
Jen, thanks a million.
Yeah, not
enjoy
at all.
Happy storytelling and everything else you're doing. You're one of those people who buzzes around and does a whole load of things.
Ah, sure. What else would you be doing?
All right, Sloane, talk to you again soon. Bye-bye.